Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. This hour on the program, Old Town Lansing glass artist Craig Mitchell Smith joins us here to talk about his very interesting line of work and about his move to Old Town Lansing. A guy who has been so well known in the East Lansing musical community for so many years, Josh White Jr., joins us later on this hour. Josh White Jr., along with fellow roots musician Reverend Robert Jones, will honor Josh White Sr. and Lead Belly tonight at the East Lansing Public Library. And our Emmanuel Berry had a chance to sit down with both of them. And we also meet some very interesting folks who are involved in the robotics, the Hazlitt Robotics Club out in the Hazlitt School District. We'll stop by, and we focus on them in Neighbors in Action here later on this hour on Current State. At the top of the program, an important debate over urban farming in Michigan continues today here in Lansing. Officials from the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development and others will discuss proposed rule changes governing farm animals in developed residential areas. A focal point of the discussion, taking place at a meeting of the Michigan Agricultural Commission, is a proposal to give local communities the authority to decide for themselves where to allow farm animals. Many of Michigan's urban farmers have roundly criticized the revisions. They fear local governments will clamp down on backyard animal operations. State agriculture officials respond that the new rules would not ban backyard livestock. Well, Jim Johnson's with the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. In an interview late yesterday, I first asked him about the intent of these agricultural rules. They're called GAMPs. That stands for Generally Accepted Agricultural and Management Practices.
So under the Right Farm Act, a farm is provided protection. Actually, it's an affirmative defense for nuisance complaints against a farm operation. But the condition that a farm has to meet in order to receive that conditional preemption from nuisance lawsuits is conformance with the GAMPs. And the GAMPs are a set of standards that outline behavioral and management practices on farms that help to reduce dust, noise, smells, all of these other things that are customary parts of farming operations.
And there are eight different GAMPs?
There are eight different GAMPs, everything from manure to pesticides to irrigation, and the big one today is the siting of new or expanding livestock facilities.
Now, many urban farmers are afraid that some of the proposed new rules clamp down too hard on their operations. Let's talk about a few of them. The siting rules used to apply only to operations with 50 or more animal units. You're proposing extending them to operations with any animal units, even one. Why?
Well, the challenge for us is to make a determination as to where the best fit is for livestock in the countryside. And what's happening now is we're taking livestock and we're moving it into urban settings. And what this change to the siting GAMP does is it says if you're an exclusively residential area, then that is an inappropriate place for livestock under Right Farm and under the siting GAMP. Now, it doesn't prohibit that at all. Basically, what it says is you can have those, but that's going to be a local decision. And I think that that's the big change over where we were and where we're headed with this, is that this needs to be a community decision. Is 5 chickens acceptable in our community, or is 25 chickens acceptable in our community? That needs to be a community-based decision, because there are lots of different communities across Michigan that are exclusively residentially zoned, and they should make their decision about what's an acceptable amount or type of livestock and not have one-size-fits-all kind of standard that exists at the state level.
So this would, you're suggesting that the changes you're proposing would give local governments more leeway to decide what to allow and not to allow. Is that a correct interpretation?
That, That is absolutely correct. And in fact, we've spent a lot of time working with the city of Detroit on their ordinances for urban agriculture. And in fact, that just passed for fruit and vegetable ag last fall. And we're now working with them today as they move through a process of trying to determine what is acceptable or not acceptable with regards to livestock within the city of Detroit. And we're excited about that possibility. There are real opportunities for integration of livestock farming within urban settings, but it has to fit within that urban setting. It has to. Lots of communities now have farm markets, farmers markets. They have food hubs. These are all opportunities for local folks to grow and distribute within the community, but that needs to be figured out as a community and not be dictated by some one-size-fits-all state policy.
Well, Jim, right now, how common is it for livestock to be in a in an area zoned residential in Michigan? Are we to believe that that's increasingly common then?
Oh, there's no doubt that it's increasingly common. In fact, I was out and about over the weekend, and I saw custom-made, prepackaged chicken coops for sale for $179 over the weekend. I think this is a growing opportunity, and people want to have some control over their own food production and some opportunity for income. And I think that's great. And that I don't. And it's not just expanding here, Mark. It's expanding all over the country. I mean, there are lot of very urban settings that are addressing this in very positive ways in Philadelphia and out in Seattle, places that have looked at this and said, there's an opportunity for us to expand this local food market in a way that actually meets the community's needs.
I'm curious how exactly livestock is defined in this discussion.
Yeah, so livestock actually within the Right to Farm Act actually names a number of different animals or animal products that are a result of livestock. So it goes on to talk about horses, pigs, cows, what you would traditionally think of as livestock, and then also their products like eggs and cheese and those kinds of things that are part of that farming operation.
So someone who keeps three or four chickens in a town is not facing a whole lot more red tape?
Well, the interesting thing is that they may be. It depends on whether or not that community actually allows for livestock within it or not, and doesn't it make more sense for that community to make that decision themselves rather than have the state decide that? There are places like Ann Arbor that actually allow for a certain number of chickens within the city itself. Now, they don't allow a rooster, and part of the reason for that is because roosters crow early in the morning, and why should your neighbors have to put up with that? And so they're trying to figure out how they can allow livestock within their community without actually increasing the risk of having some sort of nuisance conditions within that community.
So I take it urban farming has expanded under the existing regulations. Is it generating a lot more complaints?
It is. The interesting thing is most of the complaints today, though, are being generated by those who are not interested in a change in the GAMS itself. What we're not hearing from are those neighbors who are sitting next to these places that actually have livestock. What we are hearing from are those who are responsible for overseeing, zoning compliance issues within those communities. So we're not hearing from the individual landowners that are next door, but we are hearing from, for example, township officials and township lawyers who are fielding the complaints from next door neighbors and passing those on to us on behalf of the citizens that live next to those people who have livestock.
In general, James Johnson, how are you interpreting the resistance to this? And are the revisions misunderstood to any extent?
Well, I think the revisions are actually misunderstood. There's a lot of misinformation out there about this completely bans urban agriculture. That is not our intent at all. As I said earlier, our real intent here is for urban ag to expand. We think there's a real opportunity here. The challenge, though, is for the local communities to make the decision as to what that expansion looks like. And we're all for that. And I think as you you think about some of these areas. The city of Detroit, for example, has 35 square miles of open land. There's a lot of opportunity for a big expansion of urban ag there. And I can imagine small herds of cows, for example, producing a unique artisan cheese, for example, and that being going into market within the city of Detroit. There are tremendous opportunities there.
It's apparently stipulated that GAMPs be based on sound science, but some opponents to the citing GAMP complain that sound science doesn't come into play here. Can you help us understand this point?
Yeah, there's no doubt that this is a policy decision. You know, how do you evaluate sound science with regards to people's interpretation as to what is acceptable and not acceptable as a neighbor? Your sense of what is acceptable may be completely different from my sense of what is acceptable, and I don't know where the science comes in to say that you're right and I'm wrong. If you and I live on opposite sides of somebody who has chickens, it's a very, very difficult position to identify regarding science. And so there's no doubt that this change actually becomes a policy, programmatic change, and not necessarily one that's based on science.
Mm. It would appear that Michigan's Right to Farm Act from 81 has come full circle in a way. The law was meant to protect rural farmers from nuisance complaints as a result of urban sprawl. Is it fair to say that the law needs to evolve to better accommodate urban farming and livestock who in theory at least, also have a right to farm?
Sure, and I think that there's an opportunity for that to happen. And you are absolutely right, Mark, that the original purpose behind the Right to Farm Act when it was passed in 81 was that people were moving from the urban centers out into the country and then suing farmers individually. And so the Right Farm Act was passed to say, listen, you're not going to get a court approval on a case where somebody is in compliance with these GAMPs. So what ended up happening was that those same people then went to their local townships and said, we need to change the township ordinance that further restricts farming through zoning. And so that's what resulted in the change in the act in 1999, where the decision was made to say that the Right to Farm Act actually preempts zoning in Michigan, as long as that zoning does not extend Right to Farm in any way. And but again, that was never intended to exempt zoning in an urban setting. And I know I've said this before, but the challenge for us is whether or not it's generally accepted. It's a generally accepted agricultural management practice to have livestock in an urban setting. And we're saying that, no, that's not a generally accepted ag and management practice, but that doesn't mean it can't exist. And that has to be a local community decision.
I'm wondering about the patterns in play here. Are city administrators and city councils and town councils generally supportive of these changes?
We're just starting to see some of that. The set of GAMPs themselves, the new GAMP language was actually put out for public review early in January. We're starting to get feedback. Obviously, those that have been against this decision, and we've been working on this now for 5 years, so we have a long history of trying to address this in a way that's meaningful. Part of the challenge is how do you provide this flexibility within the urban setting and yet not create an additional problem for farmers out in rural Michigan at the same time. And so we've been dealing with this for a long time. We're just now starting to get feedback from some of the other organizations that are out there who are concerned about this and beginning to weigh in. And we're starting to see some support within those organizations that in an urbanized setting, in an exclusively residential area, it does make sense to them that be a local decision.
How do you think the Ag Commission feels about the revisions? Do you have any thoughts as to how they will respond?
Well, they'll take the language to them and talk at the commission meeting about the changes, what they what the attempt is here in this new language, what we're trying to get addressed in this. They'll have a month period of time. I'm sure that there will be people who will make comments, and they'll have a month then to mull that over. That's an independent group, and I would expect that the commission will take the comments seriously and look at that and look at the opportunities overall and see where this makes sense or where it doesn't. And I don't really have a good feel for how they'll actually decide in the end.
That was Jim Johnson, who's the Environmental Stewardship Director at the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Again, the Michigan Agricultural Commission hears about proposed changes to rules governing backyard livestock today in Lansing. Its current state on 90.5 WKAR, Lansing's Old Town has become a haven for the city's artistic community over the years. This week, the Old Town arts and business communities welcome a big catch. One of the area's most prominent artists, Craig Mitchell Smith, has moved his Glassworks Gallery from a prime spot in the Meridian Mall in Okemos to a new spot in Old Town Lansing. Craig Mitchell Smith joins us today to explain his reasons for the move. Craig, nice to see you.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Also with us today, Louise Gradwall. Louise is Executive Director of the Old Town Commercial Association. Welcome.
Hi.
You spent 4 years running a gallery in the Meridian Mall. Why move from there to Old Town Lansing?
Well, one, I love Old Town. It's where I've been spending my playtime for years, so I wanted to be closer to my home. I live very near there, and it's just an artistic community. I wanted to be part of something larger. And as soon as the word got out that I was moving to Old Town, I started having people from Old Town come find me in the mall to welcome me there. It's a totally different experience. The mall was very good for me, and I was very glad to be there, but I want to be part of an artistic community instead of the guy who sticks out.
Now, you, I imagine in a mall setting, though, you're guaranteed some amount of foot traffic through the mall. Do you feel like you're guaranteed foot traffic in Old Town?
No. Okay. That's part of the idea. My business has changed so much in the last few years that when I opened the space at the mall, that was my first retail experience, and all my sales were coming from walk-in traffic, where people were coming in, seeing the work, and buying items. And over the last few years, what's happened is my business has changed to the place. I'm now doing some large shows, and so the bulk of my work is now far away, and I'm doing mostly custom commissions. So I have the flexibility to move where I'd like to be. And I can work on the shows wherever. Nice. I'd like to, and people will come to me for custom commissions. For me, it's a lot easier to work without the distraction. I'm a talker, so people will come in the mall, and I won't get anything done because I'll talk to them.
Now, along with the gallery, is there going to be workspace involved?
Yes.
In Old Town?
And one of the main reasons for moving to the mall is I have tripled the production space. I have a smaller gallery at the new location. It's the same square footage that I had at the mall, but it's a much larger production facility. We have 3,000 square foot to work in. So that's tripled our space. I have 4 employees, and we were all over each other trying to make the glass. And now we have dedicated workstations. We have space.
You had workspace in the mall, just not as much.
Yep.
The proportions were flip-flopped.
Yep, exactly. We flipped it. I had 4,000 square foot there. I have 4,000 square foot here. But now it's 3,000 square foot for us to work in and 1,000 square foot to display.
Interesting. Louise, tell us about, your gallery will be open tonight. Is this the first time tonight?
Our soft opening is tonight for the Old Town Chocolate Walk. Our grand opening is the 23rd on Sunday.
Sounds like fun. Louise, tell us about the Old Town Chocolate Walk.
Yeah, so this is the first time we've ever done anything like this. So participants, we sold out actually last night, so we have 177 people doing this walk through Old Town. We have 17 stops along the way, so people will be going from, you know, Cravings to Catalyst to Craig's Gallery and lots of other places.
17 in Old Town?
17, yep. Mm-hmm. So we'll be able to get and all different types of chocolates. So everyone's ordered from a different retailer or, you know, and a lot of them are Michigan chocolates, even coming from Traverse City. So kind of cool.
Makes you the Michigan chocolate capital for one night.
for one night at least.
And your grand opening is set for the 23rd?
It's set for the 23rd, Sunday from 12 to 5, and that's when we'll have everything properly displayed. We are put together with, you know, baling wire right now, but it will be perfect by the 23rd.
I'm sure.
And people are welcome.
I'm sure
then.
It's the most artistic baling wire in Michigan.
I'm sure.
There's a lot of hot glue holding stuff together right now.
You mentioned the welcome you've received from Old Town Lansing, but in another way, you are competition for some of the other artists who are there.
Well, I guess I just don't see it because no one does what I do and I don't do what they do. I think there's enough to go around. And I also think that galleries, people come to gallery districts and will go from one place to another.
That's just how it works.
That's just the dynamic. Just how it works. I would rather be surrounded by other galleries than shoe stores.
Sure. Louise, were you and the members of the Old Town Commercial Association happy about the news? I mean, what was it like when you found out Craig was moving in?
Well, he, you know, walked in my office, and I swear, my intern was sitting next to me. I'm like, you don't realize, like, this guy is huge. And, you know, it's really exciting to have business owners that are passionate and care and want to be a part of your community. You know, we have some really awesome anchor businesses, and to add Craig to the mix is just a phenomenal catch. And, you know, he has so much to bring to Old Town, and he's just committed. He's already joined my design committee, you know, and so he's investing his time beyond his passion of his work. So that's the goal of any Main Street director.
Part of the appeal of Old Town has been its funky vibe, tiny businesses, quirky businesses, welcoming to the gay community. Do either of you see that shifting over time in any way? Is there any risk Old Town might outgrow its charm in some way?
I don't think we'll let it.
Okay.
I don't think so either. I think the people that have property and people that own businesses, you know, we're considered a playful district, and they want to stay that way. You know, we had a snowball fight in the middle of the road last week.
Yeah, you can't do that at the mall.
Yeah, that just doesn't happen everywhere.
I don't think people want to take that away, you know, because that's what makes Old Town Old Town.
Yeah, that's why we all go there.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Louise Gradwall of the Old Town Commercial Association and glass artist Craig Mitchell-Smith, who is about to open his new studio space in Old Town. Louise, what does Old Town lack, though? What sorts of things would help Old Town businesses? Is there a parking issue? Are there transportation options you'd like to see? What?
Oh, there's a lot of things I would like to see. But definitely a destination restaurant is what we need. You know, having the anchor restaurant there that's open late and offering just kind of a variety of food would be huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Craig, what do you think?
I agree. I want good food.
Yeah. Okay.
And I work late, so I would like someplace that's open late.
What's the vacancy rate like in Old Town?
It's just under 9% today.
Okay. Just mm-hmm. under just 9%. Under. So if someone wanted to bring a business to Old Town, theoretically, there's space for
them. There is. There's actually a couple of smaller locations that are available and coming available. So if they are interested, they're welcome to contact me.
Has the winter been hard on Old Town?
Extremely.
I mean, with the jazz festival in the summertime and some of the other outdoor events, I imagine you've kind of factored a slump into just the activity in Old Town during the colder months.
Oh yeah, and the ice storm killed, you know, holiday business. That was the really hard thing for our small businesses in particular. You know, and I think we've just had a really harsh winter, and it's hard to get people going on the street. So that's why the Chocolate Walk was really launched, you know, is to get people out there and bundle up and realize the beauty that lies within our little town.
It must have concerned you a little bit, though, with all the snow that we've gotten, because you want people to walk, but
you,
at the same
time,
we have been so hammered by snow
yes.
that factors into this.
Mm-hmm.
Craig, since you work in glass, were there any special challenges to moving from Okemos to Old Town?
Yeah, slip and fall.
Yeah.
It was a nightmare. The move took me 30 days. We were working consistently. My entire crew was packing up the spaces from the mall. mall. It was 0 degrees. I had the door open from the mall. It was endless to take some 7,000 items, inventory them, and bring them to the new location, yeah. and then try and make sense of it again. It was like dismantling a Rubik's Cube.
Were you without a? Were you shut down completely, for some period of time?
I closed the mall New Year's Eve, and then I'll open again tonight. So I've had done no business for the last month. It's taken us this long just to move the facility, get the wiring in. I had to rewire the entire facility. I use enormous amounts of power for my kilns. I wanted the place to be beautiful.
How many pieces have you created, and how long have you been working in glass?
I've been making glass just under 7 years, and I would have no idea how many pieces I've made, but they're going all over the world now.
But the commission work is the main part of the meal here for you these days. That's grown up.
I'm doing a lot of commission work. I just installed a piece at Sparrow Professional Building last night. I finished at 10 p.m. And then my next gig is I'm doing the entrance to Epcot Center at Disney and a large sculpture for the Butterfly House. So I leave in 2 weeks for Florida. And then I'm doing the Chicago Flower Show with a display of my work. And then I open a large show of 30 sculptures at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. And that opens in May. So I'm completely booked until the 1st of June.
How exciting. And Old Town is your new home. We want to thank Craig Mitchell Smith, glass artist new to Old Town. He'll be open tonight during the Chocolate Walk and then officially opens to the public tomorrow. Grand opening on February 23rd. Louise Gradwald is executive director of the Old Town Commercial Association. Good luck. Have fun.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Legendary African-American folk singer Josh White's entrance into the world of music happened at age 7 when he took a job leading blind musicians across the states. Eventually, Josh White became an accomplished musician. He's credited with bringing gospel, blues, and black folk music to the masses. In 1941, he became the first African-American musician to give a performance at the White House. Beyond his accomplishments in music, Josh was also an advocate for international human rights. Josh passed his passion for music and his desire for equality onto his son, Josh White Jr. Josh White Jr. started performing with his father at age 4 and continues to share his father's music and legacy today. Now, Josh White Jr., along with American Roots champion Reverend Robert Jones, will honor Josh White Sr. and the king of the 12-string guitar, Lead Belly, in a performance tonight at the East Lansing Library. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Josh Jr. about his upcoming performance, and he started by explaining why it's important to share his father's and Lead Belly's stories.
You can never know enough about people, and as famous Lead Belly and my old man were, there are still people who need to know their story. And that's what we want to do. The very first 4 folk musicians to be put on a United States postal stamp, 2 of those people were Lead Belly and Josh White. How many people know that?
I didn't.
You know? So bringing their stories to people, let people know that there were 2 black men in the 30s, 40s, 50s who were not only entertainers, but those who spoke on social situations. It's almost easier for a black musician to speak out because of the notoriety as opposed to your average black person who may say something and may not wind up getting home that night. I mean, the story of Lead Belly, the fact that the man wrote the song Irene Goodnight and was in jail and was pardoned by the governor of Texas for the song Irene Goodnight. We're talking in the 30s, 40s, a black man playing 12-string guitar. Come on. I think it's an interesting story. And what it is it's going to be a conversation between Lead Belly and Josh White, and as if there is no one else there. It's like we just walk back into the dressing room, did one set, we're about to do another one, we have a little time, we sit and talk, then we leave.
I think above all, people would say that your father was, he's an entertainer. So what's the greatest lesson that your father taught you about being a performer?
If you're going to sing a song, you have to believe it. Because if you don't believe what you're singing, those you're singing to won't believe it. Two, if you're going to sing a song, make sure they can understand what you're singing. It didn't matter whether he didn't push any kind of song at all. But those two things were important. If you're going to sing, believe what you're singing or no one is going to believe you, and make sure they can understand.
I guess, what kind of songs do you believe in then?
What kind of songs do I believe in?
Yeah.
Songs that show that we're all one, that we should appreciate variations in colors and religions. But there's a song called Free and Equal Blues that speaks about you remove the skin, the outer layer, and we're all the same.
There's a molecule, there's a molecule, son, and the darn thing has no race. And that was news, yes, that was news. That was very, very, very special news. 'Cause ever since that day, we've had those free and equal blues.
That's what you have to keep pressing to people. Appreciate the differences. But no one is better than, there's no head higher than yours.
Why do you think that the subject of equality is still so important in music today?
It brings people together. It shows that we all are touching the same thing. We're all, with our varieties, we're all the same. You know, it's like doing to others as you'd have others do to you, as opposed to doing to others before they do unto you. You have to remind people. Remember, every day they're hearing negative things, you know, all over. They need to hear that we can do it. We can do it together.
You have a huge array of songs to choose from for your performance tonight, including your father's rendition of House of the Rising Sun.
There is a house in New Orleans they call the Rising Sun. And it's been the ruin of a many poor girl and me, oh God, for one.
There are many versions of that song, but tell us what makes your father's rendition special.
Lead Belly, Woody Guthrie, and my father all heard that song from an Appalachian singer. And the song had no minor chords, all major chords. If you listen to my old man's rendition, all the rest, it starts with an A minor chord. When my father heard it, for some reason, within his creativity, he put that minor chord in. And maybe the minor goes a little better with a sad song than a major chord. Maybe that's it. I never thought about it that way, but maybe that's it. Because the minor chord fits better than a major chord at the beginning of the song, to me. But maybe it's also, I've been hearing it since I was 3 1/2.
Yeah.
But it just, I've heard it done at a faster pace, but the old man's A minor chord stayed with the song.
Your father accomplished a lot in his career and with his music. What do you feel is his greatest contribution to culture today?
That he was prepared to entertain you in ways that make you smile and make you cry, but also make you think. Music is a very powerful thing, and people can hear things sometimes much better if it's sung to them than spoken to them. And that is why the variety of songs, because there are different topics you want to speak on. But music will bring it closer to you than the spoken word. I think that's what you feel. And that's why it's important to believe in the song that you're doing, because if you believe it, there's more emotion behind it. And so you sing what you feel is right in your heart, and that you know it goes out to others. And you don't expect everyone to enjoy you. And that's what makes a horse race. But you will touch those who are like-minded. And sometimes music can wear on somebody. And at first they weren't sure. Then a few days later, weeks later, all of a sudden,
you're singing along.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Beyond bringing back the past to light through your performance tonight, you're also working on a project called Living History. Explain a little bit about how this works.
Living History is a teaching program that I've been involved in since 1991. We do it all over the state of Michigan. We teach history by my female partner and I going into a classroom, third grade and up, because they need cognitive skills. We remove the desks, and if we're going to learn about the Underground Railroad, we all go back in our minds to the year 1850, and they become the people that they're learning about. And so they get a chance to feel what it was like back then, because they're not reading it, they're living it. So you get you get the emotional feeling of what it felt like to be a slave, or be a black or white person fighting racism. And when you walk a mile in someone's shoes, you're not going to forget.
Your legacy seems to be so much tied with your father's, and it's a part of your work is continuing to share and preserve his accomplishments. Why is it important for you to continue to celebrate him?
One never forgets their parents. And if they happen to have been someone of interest to others, then you want to keep it alive. I enjoy doing my father's music the way he did it to those who remember and love him. And for those who never heard this kind of guitar playing or how the songs are structured, and that makes you feel that you've done something worthwhile in your life that will sustain way past when you're gone.
Josh White Jr. will be joined by Reverend Robert Jones at the East Lansing Public Library tonight at 7 p.m. to perform Black Fathers of Folk Music, a celebration of Lead Belly and Josh White Sr. Josh, thanks for your time.
I appreciate it. I thank you, too.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
Being so young and foolish, oh Lord, I let a rambler lead me astray. Go tell my baby sister, don't do what I have done.
90.5 WKAR in Current State. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday and time for our award-winning Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the Mid-Michigan community a better place. That's right. We're pleased to announce that Neighbors in Action has received a Broadcast Excellence Award from the Michigan Association of Broadcasters, one of four that WKAR Radio has received, including Station of the Year. Well, now that little glance in the mirror is over, let's move on to today's Neighbors in Action segment. The Hazlitt Robotics Club engages youth in the Hazlitt School District and surrounding areas in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math, and they do that through robotics. And here to tell us more are coaches of two of the robotics teams, Todd Wilson and Klaus Buchholz. Also with us is Kian Bates, a sixth grader at Hazlitt Middle School and a participant in the Hazlitt Robotics Club. Welcome to Current State, one and all. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks.
Klaus, tell us about how this all got started.
Well, 6 years ago, two Hazlitt parents, former GM engineers, Bob Watson and Kim Schramm, we're looking for a place to have their young son participate with the first LEGO Robotics, first LEGO League Robotics. And they held a meeting in Hazlitt, and their turnout was huge. There were lots of interested parents and students. So we formed two teams, one for the elementary school and one in middle school teams.
Todd, you coach one of the younger teams. You're most active from late summer through the holidays. How does a typical season unfold?
We begin early in the spring, trying to pick up new kids and get them familiar with the system and how it all works. We don't actually find out what the year's challenge is until September. So we start early, meeting about once a month, expose the kids to the system and the programming language and all that sort of thing, run them through various activities, and then we ramp up as we get closer to competition time.
The year's challenge, though, what is that?
Well, for first LEGO League, every year they define a theme for that year. The kids are asked to develop some sort of a technological advancement based on the theme. For instance, this year's theme was Nature's Fury. It was all about natural occurrences and disasters, weather events, things like that. The challenge board for every given year for the robot portion of the competition is based on that theme, and we don't actually know what that challenge is until September, and then we compete a month later.
Okay. Kian, why did you join the robotics club?
Well, I thought it would be interesting, and I kind of like to use my hands and build things, so I just thought it would be fun to do.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite part of being involved in this? Is it the actual assembly or the creation of a robot?
It's kind of a number of things. It's the skit that we have to pull off every year and building the robot.
And what have you learned?
Well, I have learned that, there's a ton of things involved with engineering that normally you don't know about.
I'm sure. Like, give us one example.
It takes a lot more programming than you would believe, because if you were to have one simple program, like to make it go forward and backwards, it would take quite a bit of programming. You'd have to measure how far you want it to go forward and how far you want it to go backwards.
Mm-hmm. Were you interested in robotics before you joined the club then? Did you know much about robotics before you joined the club?
No, not really. Not until it was at our science fair once.
Okay. And now from the first LEGO League, kids can move up to the VEX robotics teams in junior high and high school. Klaus, I imagine it gets more intense and specialized in high school. How do the competitions work at that level?
That's right. The VEX robots are based on metal parts. If the older listeners might remember Erector sets, it's very similar to that.
Okay.
With the modern electronics and motors and programming. We use a professional level programming language called C, Robot C it's called. And the students learn how to do that, and they pick it up pretty quickly after using the graphical programming language from the LEGO robotics.
This activity has taken off so much. I mean, even Governor Snyder mentioned it in his State of the State address. What do you make of that, Todd?
I think there's been a lot of focus on STEM-based programs in the country, and which is a fantastic thing. And kids just seem to be generally interested in being challenged at this, you know, at this kind of level,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, more traditional
yeah.
methods and programs.
Okay. How many teams do you have altogether, Klaus?
We have currently three VEX teams and four LEGO teams.
Four LEGO teams.
And how many kids participating altogether?
About 15 kids in VEX.
Yeah, and there's about 35 to 40 in FLL. So,
is this cutting edge enough that you don't have to promote it too awful much to get kids interested, or do you conduct some kind of outreach to connect with kids?
Well, we do some outreach. We present at the science fairs in our area so that kids can see it. It's less of being about it being something that the kids latch onto and show immediate interest in. It's more just awareness that it even exists. That's always kind of
okay.
been the challenge for us, is to for people to know that we're there.
This is the first year you've managed to put together an all-girls robotics team, Gear Girls.
Yes.
You've been trying to have one for a couple of years. What have been the challenges?
Purely to get some of the young girls in our community interested and involved. We were presented with a challenge from one of our sponsors, our donors, the Haslett Kiwanis, 2 years ago, to build a girls team. And we almost made it year before last, but this past year we were able to accomplish it, and they did fantastic.
Kian, I've got to ask you, why do you think more girls aren't interested in the robotics team?
Well, I guess it's because most girls really aren't just interested in doing science and math, even though it can be very interesting when you give it a big chance.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to keep studying science?
Yes.
Is that going to be a focus, do you think, of your education going forward?
Most likely, I do believe so, because I'm into that.
Yeah.
I just like to do it.
So you would expect to be a member of the high school robotics team when you're that age?
Yeah, most likely.
Okay. What's the payoff here? Do these kids surprise you in any way, Todd and Klaus?
Oh, they do. Yeah, they especially when they're challenged by a tournament, matching other teams from around the state and around the world.
The competition is still a focus then.
Absolutely. That's the real payoff. Yeah, we work hard every meeting, building and programming and testing and being frustrated. But at the competitions, it all pays off. So
yeah,
that's the fun part.
Yeah, and actually, in our competitions, they're chaotic. There's a lot going on, a lot of people, a lot of just activity everywhere, and it's the parents that get, that get more tense about the whole thing. The kids just latch in and they go to town. And it's great to see some of the, because I think generally there's just a simpler approach to a complex problem, because the kids aren't weighed down with all this additional information that we're constantly processing, and they come up with some absolutely amazingly simple, incredible solutions to really complex problems.
Very interesting. I imagine the new Legos movie is a pretty popular movie with all your members.
I think it's popular across the board.
Who can participate in the robotics program, Klaus?
Anyone who's interested. We like to start the kids off, the younger kids in the Lego program, and from there, let them move up to the VEX.
Is there a fee?
No. So far, we've been fortunate to have enough funding that we haven't had to charge a fee. The only thing we require of the parents is to transport the kids to the tournaments.
Todd, where does your funding come from?
We solicit donations from private companies, a lot of engineering and design firms, and you guys got some corporate sponsorship, didn't you?
Yeah, I might say that the whole thing started with funding from the Michigan State University College of Engineering
Spartan Robotics
outreach program.
Yep.
What project have you been most impressed with so far, Klaus, that these teams have created?
The first year we were on VEX, the kids built a scissor lift type robot after watching a video of a construction worker using a scissor lift. And I thought to myself, oh, that's not going to work. It's going to be terrible. But they scored and they won tournaments and they went to the world tournament that year with it. So,
Todd, what about you?
For me, on the FLL side, we do the technological creations that the kids come up with as part of the theme. Some of the things that they've devised have been really kind of interesting. Like my team, Food Factor was the theme year before last, and my team designed a refrigerated box that was collapsible that fit in the back of your car to carry perishable groceries back from the store.
Mm.
Just things like that. The ideas that they come up with, particularly on the project part for FLL, are amazing.
This would appear to be part of a growing movement. Is this do a lot of the school districts in the Lansing area have robotics teams?
They do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you compete? Do you end up competing with them?
We do.
Through what you've already described.
Yep.
How far do you ever travel? I mean, you hear these stories about sports teams traveling hundreds of miles to play games. Do you guys travel a lot?
We do. We first spend the season competing around the state of Michigan. And then there's a state tournament here at MSU next month. And if you place well in that, then there you can go to the World VEX tournament in California. Mm-hmm. And our oldest team has done so in the past 3 years.
Do you have goals in terms of membership? I mean, I don't know how many students there are in the Haslett School District, but I mean, do you see your membership right now at a place and you'd say, I'd really, we can double this. There's no reason we can't double this. Do you have those kind of goals?
Oh, we absolutely have those kind of goals. The challenge is that because we're a parent-run organization and we're all volunteer, is building a program that'll sustain itself and that we get, you know, folks that come in to coach teams and do all those functions behind us as our kids get older and move up through the program. We all have children in the program, mm-hmm. all the coaches. But that the challenge has really been for us to get parents involved, mm-hmm. than the kids,
Parent volunteers.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you could use parent volunteers.
Oh, absolutely.
How many would you like to have?
How many can you get?
And where, if someone listening would like to get involved, what can they do?
The easiest way to contact us is by email. We're HazletRoboticsClub@gmail.com or HazletRobotics@gmail.com. That'll put you in contact with all of us, and we will absolutely, if you're interested in being on a team, seeing what it's all about, attending our practices, becoming involved as a parent volunteer or a coach or a mentor or any of those things.
All very cool. Todd Wilson and Klaus Buchholz are two coaches for the Hazlet Robotics Club. Kian Bates is a sixth grader at Hazlet Middle School and a member of the club. Thanks to all of you for taking time to join us today, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work, but Current State needs to know about them. Please help us out and tweet us at @KARCurrentState or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. We leave you now with a snapshot from Michigan State University. Yesterday, MSU officials dedicated Morrill Plaza, a kind of interpretive center, on the spot where the fabled Morrill Hall once stood. The 113-year-old building, which was built as a women's dormitory, was torn down last year. In its place are several brick markers and a kiosk that showcase MSU's history as the first land-grant university in the nation. Current State's Kevin Lavery attended the dedication of Morrill Plaza, where MSU President Luanna Simon explained how the kiosk will highlight the stories of educational leaders who built MSU's international reputation.
We wanted to recognize history and tradition. The sidewalk actually replicates the spine of the building. We used students and others to work with the design, and the kiosk will electronically be able to chronicle the great contribution of our faculty over the years, people that buildings are named after that you probably don't know anymore, and why they made extraordinary contributions. You know, Beale is viewed as one of the fathers of biology.
Perhaps Beale's greatest achievement was his experiment in cross-fertilization of corn, which led directly to the development of hybrid corn. His most enduring act was the establishment of the oldest continuously operated garden in the nation in 1873, Beale Botanical Garden.
And we keep forgetting that that was right here at Michigan State, along with recognition of people like Trout, who really designed a process for pasteurizing milk that we all take for granted today, but was very revolutionary in terms of both nutrition and health.
Trout is known for researching and developing a homogenization process for milk. He discovered that for homogenized milk to taste good, it must be pasteurized first.
So this is going to be a way for us to keep adding and adding those faculty profiles. People came from all the brand names to be a part of this experiment.
These pioneers and leaders played a fundamental role in transforming MSU into the prominent land-grant, world-class research university it is today.
That's Current State for Wednesday. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, serving the MSU and Oakland University communities with personal and business financial services, including checking and savings plans, loans, mortgages, and online transactions. Insured by NCUA.